Porter. Bruce Rawls is here for our mini-series, and he's going to be talking to us about the three R's of forgiveness. And I think you'll really enjoy this little process and how it works. So, Bruce, right now I'm going to mute my mic and let you speak. And if you want to ask a question or if somebody has any questions, I will let you know. And anybody who's in the room who has any questions, please write them on the board. If you want to raise up your hand and ask, I think I can do that too. I think I can put you on the mic and still keep Bruce and everything else. So anyway, I'm muting my mic for you, Bruce Rawls. This mic is all yours.
All righty. Thanks, Lynn, and appreciate your extra efforts and getting the connection made and recording and so forth, and always much appreciated. So as you mentioned, I thought it'd be fun to review, because I always need the review, the three steps of forgiveness that the Course talks about. And it really, in a sense, is just really one decision, but we can kind of look at it as three steps. And I did Google that and found just a short while ago, something that elaborates this, that I'd forgotten that Ken Wapnick had written about this in his fairly early work called Forgiveness in Jesus, which I actually had a copy of many years ago, but finally finished reading a couple, 2 or 3 years ago, after having it set on my shelf for quite some time. But then I picked it up, and so that's in that book. And where I found this was on miraclestudies.net/forgive_3-step, the number 3-step.html. And I'll put that link on the post that I do about this talk. So if you don't happen to have it, maybe I'll make a copy and paste it into the chat so Lynn could have it also. I think I'll do that right now and open up the chat window and paste that there. And then go back to reading this, because it really covers the three steps really nicely, which I think can be summarized very easily with reveal, release, and replace. And so I'm just going to read a little bit of this, and I'll comment as I go along. And this, again, is from Forgiveness in Jesus, the Meeting Place of A Course in Miracles in Christianity. And this is from pages 59 to 66 in the fifth edition of, by Ken Wapnick, copyright 1994, Foundation for A Course in Miracles, reproduced here with permission, it says. I'll give you the whole scoop here. And the quote that really is a very short section in booklet lesson 23 that starts this off and then is elaborated on, is, "You are not trapped in the world you see, because its cause can be changed. This change requires first that the cause be identified, and then second, in brackets, let go, so that third, it can be replaced. The first two steps in this process require your cooperation. The final one does not." And that's from workbook lesson 23, paragraph 5, sentences 1 through 4. I'm getting a strange echo, but hopefully that's not showing up in the room or on the recording. anyway, I'll just continue and just ignore it, which is probably symbolic of what we all need to do, of hearing ego's echo and ignoring that, right? So it says here, "The process of forgiveness essentially consists of three steps that lead us from our egos back to God." And that's the first one is the reveal, which is where we reveal that we made a bad investment, basically. We just look at our identity investment, egos that promise but never deliver strategy, that it really results in less than joyous thoughts. And we do all three of these steps with our inner kindness teacher, which we could also call the Holy Spirit or the Jesus of the Course. And that revelation, that revealing, that recognition is just looking at the investment that we tried to make in doing it our own way, and it didn't work. And it usually takes some form of condemnation, or as this first paragraph starts, it says, "The first entails a recognition that what we have attacked and judged against in another is indeed what we have condemned in ourselves." So that recognition invariably involves reeling back in our projection and realizing that what we seem to experience outside of ourselves is really back in the mind. And so in a sense, we're kind of going through the reversal of the shields of oblivion that toward the end, you know, toward the end of the first page of the workbook, lesson 136 talks about, where we're basically saying, the outer shield of oblivion isn't going to fool me. But only because we've taken the hand metaphorically of our inner kindness teacher and are willing to look at that with that guidance. And with that guidance, we see that there's nothing outside me. So that first distraction, diversion, denial, of the world being something outside myself is neutralized in that moment, because we realize that there isn't anything outside. Ideas don't leave their source. And so if that's the case, then anything from the most minor irritation to the most, you know, out and out holocaust in our imagination is, you know, it's all the same thing. And it's all happening in the mind. And once it's in the mind, then we get to the inner shield of oblivion, which is the fear of looking within that the Course talks about. And that fear invariably stems from the belief, and it's only a belief, that we threw God under the bus. We somehow convinced ourselves that we shattered perfect oneness, that we've dethroned God, and somehow the horror of horrors, we have to face this schizophrenic, angry God who's going to come after us and you know, destroy us, or, you know, strike us blind, as the Course says euphemistically. And that horror, that terror, that fear is beyond our imagination. But we only have to deal with a little bit of it at a time, and we get all the help we need to look at it by just taking metaphorically the hand of our inner kindness teacher and saying, okay, this feeling, this discomfort that I'm feeling has no foundation in truth. And when we rise above our personal battleground by continuing to hold that hand metaphorically, we see that the guilt is unfounded. And so we reveal and then we release. But let's finish the first step here. I'm just going to read this section here, and I'll start this paragraph over. The first entails a recognition that we have attacked and judged against another is we have condemned in ourselves. This is the first step in reversing the process of projection and undoing its effects. So by reversing the process of projection, we're reeling it back in, just like a fishing pole there, back into the mind where it never left its source. As long as we maintain the problem is not in us but in someone else, our attention will have been successfully diverted from the source of the problem, which is always in the mind. The ego fixes our attention away from the guilt, and by convincing us that it is not inside us, we devote our attention to correcting the problem where it is not, which is pretty darn ineffective and, needless to say, frustrating when we participate in that seek but do not find approach, right? All projection.
So, Bruce, can I ask you a question here before we go any further?
Oh, sure.
Okay. Let's see. Why am I hearing myself?
You're getting echo too, huh?
Okay. I guess it's okay. Anyway, so the question I have, okay, you talked about the inner shield of oblivion and the outer shield of oblivion. Uh-huh. And first, the outer shield of oblivion. What are some examples of what that is? What is the outer shield of oblivion? What does it consist of? How would I recognize it? How would I know that I was being caught up in it? And the inner shield. What are some ways that you can look at that?
Well, you're just setting me up perfectly for my favorite one of my favorite acronyms, which is GIST, or GIST, which really contains the first letter is the inner shield, and the other three are the outer shield, and those are just sort of general guidelines that I found really helpful. The inner shield being the guilt, which is, you know, that's when we get way past the outer shield. And ego goes into maximum alert mode because it doesn't want us to look at the mind. But the outer shield is the IST in the GIST, and that's anything involving individuality, space, and time. So we could think of countless examples of that. So let's just start with space. Anything that seems to be different in terms of distances, or, you know, certainly nationalities, gender differences, political differences, anything that seems to be something that separates us. And oftentimes that's a spatial thing because, you know, certainly if there's other people in other countries or even, you know, across the street, you know, anything that makes a we and a they distinction that becomes a big deal where we no longer participate in shared interests but in separate interests, that's one way that the whole dimension of space can be used by the ego. And just our everything in our senses reinforces that by default unless we intentionally look at the opportunities that we have to turn it around and see the interconnection that we have with everyone. And then time is the other dimension that we think that we've lost opportunities or that, you know, we have to wait until X, Y, or Z in order to be happy or peaceful. And so that's another huge dimension that the ego's, again, that distraction is always in the seek but do not find category, is always something that's outside of ourselves, whether it's space or time. But in time, there's things that we may have a nostalgic feeling about. Oh, if I only had this again, or if I could only achieve this or attain this or have this or be this or whatever, you know, once, you know, let alone again. And then individuality, I think, is another big category that the whole idea that we have a special specific story. So the whole realm of specialness of anything that we make a big deal, better and less than, there's incredible, depth and breadth and range of ways in which we can make permutations of these differences, a big deal. So I think that's where the outer shield of oblivion comes in is the body and the world and all of its variations by default. Kind of using the idea the ego speaks first and is wrong and the Holy Spirit waits until we're done, you know, turning up the volume on the ego's channel and finally decide it's not working for us and we, you know, fade it down and then it can get through. And that's that peaceful voice that says, well, hey, you know, maybe that's not working out so well for you. You want to try a different approach here. So does that help? There's countless examples, of course, Lynn. And I think we.
Yeah, no, that is really good. So these are the things, the tools that the ego uses. The outer shield is everything that we project out into the world and we see and we believe is real, is when I win the lottery, when I accept the atonement, when I lose 20 pounds, when I move to France, all of those things. It all has to do with that projection, and then the inner shield, the one that really is holding everything together, is the guilt. Uh-huh. And the guilt is behind all of those things. Our belief in those things and our attraction to those things is the attraction to guilt.
Exactly.
All right. So I'm going to again mute and let you continue on. Thank you, Bruce.
Oh, thank you. And those are great, great examples. And yeah, really, it could be anything too. And the attraction to guilt, of course, is really the thing that we're ultimately in need of undoing. Because as long as we think that we merit punishment, because unconsciously we think that we pulled off the impossible, which is making up a world that is less than perfectly peaceful, we're going to continue to, you know, travel down unconsciously a masochistic martyr trajectory, keep finding ways to beat ourselves up. I'll just tell a very minor one on myself. Today I went out for a walk this afternoon and I meandered around. I just grabbed a $20 bill thinking I'll just go by the grocery store that's about, you know, half a mile from here and pick up some vitamins that I wanted to get. And I get there with a $20 bill in my pocket and discover that I found them after, you know, considerable searching because it wasn't in the usual round bottles in a box. And then I discovered it was $19.99, but that was taxable. So it's like, oh, I'll have to come back now. but you know, it's like one of those things that's like, I could have gotten upset and just said, oh, darn, you know, but I realized it's not a big deal. I mean, it just any little thing that's, you know, is potentially capable of upsetting our peace of mind. If I realize that is a symbol, not only of you know, certainly the magical thinking of thinking that something outside me is going to make me happy or whatever, but also that, you know, I seem to not have what I need at that moment. And yet, the instant, you know, and it just took, a few seconds to realize, oh, I have an opportunity to either get upset about this or to just gently laugh and continue on. So I chose the latter. But I think any time that we can, you know, and obviously, you know, there's things that happen in our lives that aren't so small in our minds because we all are converts to the cult of orders of difficulty, right? We all think that, to paraphrase George Orwell, that, you know, all animals are equal. At least we give lip service to that, but we all somehow, because of our belief in differences, we think that some animals are more equal than others, you know. And I just think Orwell really nailed it so beautifully with that. So it's the seek and do not find principle. And we don't want to find the peace because we think we don't deserve it. We think that on some unconscious level, it's usually not very conscious at all, but on some unconscious level, we think that if I was able to use the power of my mind to make up a universe where God appears to be absent, then I must be this horrible thing. But, you know, we don't state it in those words, but I think that's the unconscious narrative that goes on.
So. Exactly. And I just want to just, if you don't mind, if I just pop in.
Oh,
here.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
This has been and if you think about this, just think about this. How often in your life have you been felt guilt and shame and helplessness when you look around at the world and you see that things seem to be just going to hell in a handbasket? You know, people are being murdered right and left. There's starvation. There's global warming. The oceans are being polluted. Everything's being destroyed. You look around and I always, and maybe I'm not like everyone, but I always feel guilty for that. I feel guilty because I feel responsible for it.
And you did it, Lynn.
That's why people do this. That's why people become environmentalists and go out and become activists and, you know, want to vote for people and go into politics, is because they think they can fix it. They think that somehow they're responsible to fix it, and the way they can fix it is in the world, when the actual reason for all of it is this feeling of guilt, this inner shield of oblivion that is preventing me from seeing the truth about all of this and the actual forgiveness that comes from recognizing that nothing is happening.
Yes.
And
yes.
Nothing has ever happened. That's the get out of jail free card.
That's it.
Right?
Yeah.
So, okay.
And if that doesn't work, Lynn has just volunteered to take on all our guilt. So thank you, Lynn. So we're all off the hook, right? Thank you for volunteering. No, just kidding. But yeah.
I don't have a messiah complex. I'm not you. So forget about that. No hanging me up on the tree.
but that's it. I mean, we all, you know, we look at the things going on, and if we're not cognizant of the discomfort and the cause of it, and that's where the reveal comes in, is revealing to ourselves that we're complicit, and that's where half of the effort comes. But the beauty of it is, if we turn it over to that faculty that we took with us into the dream that we call variously Holy Spirit or the Jesus of A Course in Miracles, or I use Inner Kindness Teacher because I just find that a handy acronym, metaphor kind of thing. But that peaceful feeling, that the integrity, the calm and the awareness, the lucidity that allows us to step back or metaphorically, you know, kind of rise above the battleground of duality and see, not in any kind of a evasive or diversionary way, but just to honestly look at the desolation of ego's dream, and then it becomes the nothingness of it becomes apparent. The fact that it appears to be horrific at times, like some of the examples you just gave, Lynn, you know, the global catastrophes I just watched a video this morning that was talking about, the oligarchy and the big pharmaceuticals and the connections there of those, and I posted that on the ACIM blog, Facebook page, with a reminder that's like, well, that's very fascinating in a little form and kind of a reminder. But I think the deeper lesson here is it's a reminder that that's the insanity of our ego that wants to dominate and control and manipulate. But it's because it's desperate to fix the dream. It's got not just a casual dream repair technician hat on. It's got the nine alarm, fire, panic mode, garb, and it's going after it with a vengeance and with a passion, because it thinks, even though we may seem to have a calm exterior when we're in ego mode, because we've practiced that, but the ego's seek and do not find fanaticism is never calm. It's always in a panic mode, even if it appears to be on the surface, smooth and calm. So, because how could anything that divides perfect oneness be at peace? I mean, the logic of that is just insane. But as you were saying eloquently, it never happened. It never occurred. And so that revelation, the first step of the three R's, the reveal step, is really recognizing that and revealing to ourselves that ego's approach didn't work. So I'm going to read a little more of this three steps essay here. If we think of the coffee granules in the special relationship jar, an example previously discussed in the book, as representing the belief in our own sinlessness or sinfulness or guilt, the ego's goal is to keep us from ever approaching them. We either confront, as we have seen, the terror of oblivion and nothingness, or else the awesome specter of a wrathful God waiting to annihilate us. Now, again, Jesus in the Course doesn't mince a lot of words. And it seems like an exaggeration sometimes to read things like that in the Course, because it just seems so off the charts, horrendous. But there's only a stop and go. It's a binary thing. We're either in our right minds or the wrong minds, and the wrong mind is totally insane. But we don't notice that until we just start looking at the insanity of our egos, but not with condemnation, with just a gentle, calm awareness that we can do when we metaphorically are holding the hand of our inner kindness teacher and guiding us through that process. So it continues, thus by denying the guilt we hope magically to escape, but by denying the guilt, we hope magically to escape the anxiety it engenders. And there it is. I mean, that's the panic that the ego has always, but it tries to cover it up with this sort of placid thing. And then we have these experiences in the world that, we have days that seem to go nicely for us, and we say, isn't that wonderful? And, we achieve things on our to-do lists, and but if there's always kind of the sword of Damocles, if there's always the other shoe waiting to drop kind of feeling, then there's there's no lasting peace if it's not permanent. And so we can, in fact, achieve that by consistently practicing forgiveness. And it's something that is a doable thing. And I think that's the demonstration that Jesus gave us through A Course in Miracles and the practice of basically getting completely out of the way of the ego and just saying, this doesn't work. And it's obviously we're all in that process. We're all in various stages of doing that at any given moment, aren't we? Because we're so ambivalent. And I think the recognition of that ambivalence and the fact that we vacillate back and forth between sanity and insanity is something that is, a helpful reminder that we can afford to be gentle with ourselves and with everyone else as we go through this process and see more and more of that desolation doesn't have to be our identity. In fact, it couldn't possibly be our real identity. So then it goes on. It says, what the ego does not reveal, of course, is that beyond the guilt is the God who is always with us and whose loving presence dispels the ego's fearful world, which is based on separation from him. This love is the proof that the ego's premises are mistaken. And that's not just the carrot at the end of the stick. That's the whole enchilada. I mean, that's the reality that we can't even imagine how peaceful and how profoundly wonderful that state when we make it permanent is. And we don't really make it. We just get what we made out of the way, actually, to use some of the course's jargon. We unmake, if you will, the insanity by forgiving our investment in it. So I'll continue. This is the next paragraph here. It says, the ego, therefore, seeks always to keep us from approaching our guilt, and it offers many seductions, both in positive and negative forms, to distract us from becoming too close to it. Mm-hmm. Pay no attention to that dude behind the curtain, huh? Don't look too closely, says the ego. Following the ego's guidance, we continually seek lids for the jar, and these searches constitute the various life problems and involvements, both large or small, that serve to keep us from the fundamental life problem of undoing the separation and returning to God. The course elaborates on this ego ploy. And I could certainly, give countless examples. I think we all can think of many just in our everyday lives from moment to moment and day to day and year to year. Anyway, it goes on. It says, everyone in this world seems to have his own special problems, yet they are all the same and must be recognized as one if the one solution that solves them all is to be accepted. Who can see that a problem has been solved if he thinks the problem is something else? That is the position in which you find yourself now. The temptation to regard problems as many is the temptation to keep the problem of separation unsolved. And there's a visual metaphor that I've been finding really helpful lately. When I think of all the different illusions in the world and the ego's strategy to keep us endlessly distracted and diverted, trying to fix things outside of ourselves. Again, we have to reel it back in saying, oh, same problem, same solution. Go to the next one, same problem, same solution, reel it back in. Illusion A, you set it side by side with illusion B and reel it back into set next to illusion C, and all those are the same thing. And I kind of picture those as like looking out away from a center to all the different things on the periphery of a circle, countless different illusory problems. But the only real solution is above the battleground, where we've metaphorically risen above the plane of ego's hypnosis and looking down on the labyrinthine maze that it tries to keep us running through and in search of fix to illusion A and then B and C and so on ad infinitum. And then it basically becomes an opportunity to see that the solution is above the battleground by seeing all the illusions as the same, and really all we're doing is switching teachers. On the battleground, we have only one teacher, and that's, you guessed it, ego. And then above it, there's only one teacher available there, and that's our inner kindness teacher. And that's where we see that all the problems are the same. But we only see it from that perspective, from where we think we are, and where the who we believe we are, you know, we've got a world of hurt going on here. Just, you know, like you're giving those examples, Lynn, a few minutes ago. All the different things in the world, both, you know, global and local, that seem to beset us. Okay. I'm just going to read the last couple of sentences of that paragraph. The temptation to regard problems as many is the temptation to keep the problem of separation unsolved. The world seems to present you with a vast number of problems, each requiring a different answer. Yet, all this complexity is but a desperate attempt not to recognize the problem and therefore not to let it be resolved. So we're still looking at the revelation process, the reveal, step one of the process of the reveal, release, and replace. It, this particular essay goes on, as a prominent aspect of the ego's distraction, as a prominent aspect of the ego's distraction attempts is the past. So an essential element in forgiveness must be releasing the past to forgive and forget. The ego tenaciously holds on to past mistakes, using them against the attacked person, saying, I will never let you forget what you did to me. May your sin remain forever before your eyes as a damning witness to your guilt. Sound like any holier-than-thou aspect of ourselves where we've, you know, wanted to project our condemnation onto someone else? I think we all have plenty of examples of those, right? But then when we realize that it didn't work, it's like, well, why would I want to do that again? Okay, by seeing only past sins, the ego overlooks the person's present reality where God is made manifest. It is impossible to forgive and not forget. Just as light and darkness cannot coexist, neither can forgiveness and guilt. If forgiveness is to be real, the other's past must be forgotten. Now, again, this is not talking about the level of form. It doesn't mean that you do the Men in Black neuralizer on yourself. You know, it's not like saying, oh, I can't remember what happened in my experience in the world. It just means that we're forgetting in terms of the big dealness. We're letting go of our investment in our identity as having, either a vendetta or a victimhood story around person X, Y, or Z, or situation X, Y, or Z, or whatever it is, and that release is really all we need to do. And then the third R, the replacement, just kind of comes in automatically, and that's why it says, you know, the first two require our willingness and participation and cooperation with our inner kindness teacher, and that the third one, we just get the heck completely out of the way and let the Holy Spirit do it, because that's really taking the reality that's been there all along, and after we get what we put in the way out of the way, it just shows up. The replacement is automatic. So it goes on. It says, regardless of the seeming justifications for it, holding on to what has happened can only be a defense against the peace and love that is happening now, but must remain hidden in the dark and shadows of the past. The first step, therefore, questions the reality of the smoke screen so that we may realize the problem is not elsewhere. The guilt is our own. Well, we have to own it before we can release it. I think that's a crucial thing. And the ownership doesn't mean that you've, you know, signed a deed and had it notarized. You know, it just says, I chose this in my mind. And having chosen it, bingo, I can unchoose it. That's the pivotal, crucial distinction, is we, by owning up to that choice, we can say, oh, yeah, the little seemingly separate self that chose this wasn't, as I love this phrase that, you know, Ken Wapnick has, is it's not evil, it's not sinful, it's not wicked, it's just silly. It's just silly, and I can afford to let it go.
And oh, I love that silly, that, because really that's what it really is. And until you can see that it just was an innocent mistake. And you can only see that by actually looking at it, because if you keep it hidden, if you don't really seek it out and look at it, it will continue to be like it's something hidden dark in the shadows that is terrifying and awful. But if you can look at it without judging it, mm-hmm. and recognizing that it's just a silly mistake, silly is such a great word. Mm-hmm. Because just say, innocent, silly mistake. You know, that the ocean, oh my gosh, yes, you know, we're destroying everything. You know, everything is burning up. Everything is going to hell. Everything is, you know what? It's just a silly mistake. And you know what? It doesn't matter because what we are, it doesn't even have any, we don't need the ocean. We don't need the world. We don't need the universe. We don't need these bodies. We don't need these things. This is all a story we made up. And it's just a silly story. So, what happens, and what has happened to me so often, is I've gotten to the point where I'm looking, and then I start judging and becoming afraid. When I judge and become afraid, then I go back into hiding and I don't want to look anymore, and then nothing gets released. Mm-hmm. And so you can't release it until you know it's there, so you can dig it out and let it go. Because if you don't reveal it, it will just remain. You have to dig to get it out, and let the Holy Spirit take it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and the digging doesn't require a lot of effort. You don't have to rent a backhoe or an earth mover. All the only digging required is in order to maybe in the beatnik version of dig is we have to dig Holy Spirit's thought system, and by doing so, be willing to look at, without condemnation, but with a little inner smile, the idea that our mistakes had no effect on reality, and we can afford to look at all the things that we made big deals out of gently and inclusively, and to be able to say everything that I chose on my own was a mistake. And I like how you said innocence there, because an innocent mistake is one made and it's sort of an oxymoron, but I think the innocence really comes from having gone through the three R's. We're restored to the innocence we never left, because the mistake actually dissolves. When you see that you were dreaming, when you see that you were in a movie and you were identified with a character on the screen, you know, pick your metaphor, it's not like you have to drag the screen out of the theater with you. When you leave the theater, or when you wake up from the dream, you know, you hopefully, you know, when you have a silly dream, you don't carry the anger or the guilt or whatever the upsetting emotion from that dream with you through the rest of the day. And I think sometimes it's kind of funny, because I remember, you know, sometimes you have my wife sometimes would be mad at me because I did something in her dream, you know, that she didn't like. but it's like, wait a minute, this was a dream. This did not happen, you know. And I've done the same thing, you know, and you catch yourself and you realize, wait a minute, I'm upset because of a dream scenario, and that's, I think, where, you know, when we recognize the magical aspects of that and how it's, you know, made up. This is fantasy. This is phantom menaces we're talking about here. And you know, sci-fi, you know, like Richard Bach says, MGM Worlds and Warner Brothers Lifetimes, you know, we're talking high drama and high production value holograms. And boy, they seem real, but they're just holographic projections that we can afford to forgive. And from that place above the battleground. Now, having said that, I want to just comment on what you were saying about, you know, the world and everything. Also, in that favorite book of illusions, you know, there's a segment in there where, you know, Don Shimoda goes on the radio and says, you know, it's okay if we destroy the world. As long as people want planets to live on, there'll be planets to live on. And then that factors into the rest of the story, which I won't elaborate on. But the idea being that, you know, that's the truth of it. But sometimes a more diplomatic way of putting it is, it's probably, you know, sometimes more appropriate to say, And usually what happens is when we return to that peaceful place in the mind, it frees us up to do what we can do to be kind within the world, and usually in a way that is recognizable as you know, either living lightly on the planet and doing things not necessarily in an activist way, but just in a way that minimize the condemnation and minimize the damage in the mind that oftentimes reflects on the level of form. It doesn't always, but oftentimes it will just be a very gentle way of living that just as a nice byproduct, not always, but you know, sometimes it will take the form of being, you know, a kind-hearted behavior as well as, you know, as well as a thinking that reflects that awareness. So, okay, I'm going to continue on and see if we can get a little bit farther in this because it's fairly lengthy essay. But it's you know, based on, in fact, let me just skip down here to the second step because this next part is this, well, like I think I got one more paragraph. I'll skip down to the second step. The first step, therefore, questions the reality of the smokescreen so we may realize the problem is not elsewhere. The guilt is our own. We recognize it is not the other who needs to be changed, but ourselves. In this step, we say, the problem that I see is one I made up. It has no reality beyond my belief in it. It is my interpretation that has caused my loss of peace, and thus it is my interpretation that must be changed or released, right? While this step does not resolve the problem of our guilt, it at least leads us closer to its resolution. By maintaining the problems outside and thus its solution as well, we are fulfilling the ego's purpose of keeping the problem from God's answer, the Holy Spirit he placed within our mind to correct the mistaken thought of separation. By withdrawing our belief in the projection, we have taken the first step toward allowing God to speak to us from within, where he is. We sometimes see this process at work in dreams. And then it goes on with this an example, which I'll send the link and you can read the example. But I'm going to skip over to, since we only got 15 minutes left, the second step in this essay. And I like to think of these as the three R's just jump back to the three-letter acronym, reveal, release, replace. So this is the release part. The second step entails our understanding the guilt, too, represents a decision and one that can now be changed. So we've gone through the outer shield of oblivion of individuality, space, time, essentially our bodies and the world, and we've recognized that we're not going to fix it in the world, and that's where the revelation happens. We have this aha moments like, ah, it's got to be the mind. I can't solve it in the world. My dream repair technician hat is not going to fix the problem. I've got to get off the screen, out of the dream, back into the mind, out of the theater, and then I'm in a place where I can do something, where I have a real alternative that I can choose instead of the ego's fraudulent one. So now we're out of the theater. We've woken up from the dream, but we then are back to the mind where we see that what's left is the guilt, and that's what, you know, has ego slam all the alarm buttons and you know, be on red alert and high alert status. But then if we continue to look with our inner kindness teacher at that guilt, it dissolves. But only when we look at it with that awareness. So anyways, it goes on and says, the second step entails our understanding that the guilt too represents a decision and one that now can be changed. The shift is not something we can do by ourselves, but it must be something we want. This can be our choice. Our guilt is not God's gift to us. It comes from a mistaken belief about who we are and who our Creator is. Its correction is the key step in our healing, and it ultimately rests on how we experience God and our relationship to Him. Guilt, as we have seen, cannot be separated from the belief that there is something inherently wrong with us and that nothing but punishment is deserved because of our reprehensible nature. But, like, I think it's Workbook Lesson 93, is it, that says, you know, You know, we think we're the home of evil, darkness, and sin. I mean, that's the unchallenged assumption that is just mucking around and wreaking havoc in our unconscious mind until we look at it. And it's only when we look at it, we, you know, hold this little, this little, you know, fairy tale fantasy monster by the scruff of its neck and put it under the light, and it dissolves. It's because there's nothing there. Okay. From this constellation of sin, guilt, and fear, experiencing God as a loving and forgiving Father is psychologically impossible. Yeah, on the battlefield, we're not going to see it. But now that we've risen above the battlefield and allowed the Holy Spirit to, you know, press the elevator up one floor button where we're above it and we can look down on it, actually probably a lot of floors, just to really take in the whole panorama of the insanity of the craziness. And but that's really, you know, metaphorically what we do is we're in a whole different dimension beyond the polarity of the we, they, and we're now face to face with the primal causal excursion that we thought we took, the exile that we thought we made from God, and that's where the guilt lies, and that's where the terrifying idea that, you know, perfect oneness is out to get us because we messed it up, and which of course doesn't make sense, because if we killed God, then how can God come after us? But, you know, but never mind the fact that the ego doesn't think these things through. So let me start that again. From this constellation of sin, guilt, and fear, experiencing God as a loving and forgiving Father is psychologically impossible. There is no way we can hold to this ego view of ourselves and at the same time feel assured of God's loving presence in us. Love must wait behind the veils of guilt and hate, just as peace cannot be experienced where there is fear and conflict. In the second step, we must begin to look at this relationship differently. Examining the underlying premises of the ego thought system lets us see how impossible they are if God is truly a God of love. Mutually exclusive premises cannot be maintained without perpetual conflict. Well, that's really the ego's horrific machine. It's just constantly churning out problems, but some of them take the form of, you know, special love and in addition to the special hate, just you know, so we have a little bit of payoff now and then, to where, you know, because otherwise we just abandon it, you know, just in immediately, you know. But we have to have these little diversionary things that keep us going, that kind of the carrot on the stick thing is, oh, well, you're going to get this and that, and this will make you happy. And we have these little moments of, you know, of pleasure or of respite from but it's really kind of a euphoric kind of a thing. It's always something that is never completely peaceful until we, you know, make that final decision to say, ego's not cutting it. And then it says, if we believe our identity is the ego, we must also believe that God is not love, for he must punish us for our attack on him. Wacko, right? But unchallenged, that's what we all believe. Yeah. Love and forgiveness have no place in the ego's world. The ego system is heavily secured by this belief in the wrath of God, which may at any moment descend upon our guilty heads. In fact, the most threatening of all to the ego is the idea that God does not condemn us, that he loves us with an everlasting love. Yeah, we're not afraid of failure. We're afraid of the success of undoing the insanity that never was. Letting the tiny mad idea go, because it's like, whoa, can't have that, because we don't think we deserve it, which is part of that insanity. To believe a God of love can change into a God of hate and therefore fear is to attribute to him the ego's use of projection and attack. This insane idea constitutes the third law of chaos, which is described this way in the Course. God must accept his son's belief in what he is and hate him for it. This is ego talking here, of course. See how the fear of God is reinforced by this. Now it becomes impossible to turn to him for help in misery. For now he has become the, quote, enemy, unquote, who caused it, to whom appeal is useless. Yeah, the very thing that we want to turn to, in truth, we think that we've blocked off, and we think we've turned into this monster that's coming after us. Atonement thus becomes a myth of vengeance, and vengeance, not forgiveness, is the will of God. Whew, pretty whacked out, huh? Okay. And I think I'm going to just jump ahead. This next section talks about special relationships, and it goes on, gives them a couple more examples. So I'm going to jump down to the concluding paragraph of the second step. It says, "The second step thus questions our decision to be guilty now that it has been brought to our awareness. We decide now to abandon our investment in the ego as our self and our creator, choosing to identify instead with our real self, knowing that God is our loving Father. Here we say, I have chosen wrongly about myself, and now I wish to choose again. This time I choose with the Holy Spirit, and let him make the decision of guiltlessness for me." Nice. Sometimes we actually do that, don't we? Sometimes we really...
That's my favorite part of A Course in Miracles, is that at the end of chapter 5, the decision for God, where he goes through that. Because really, that's it. I decided wrongly. I'm not at peace. I can choose again. And wow, what a relief. And the Holy Spirit will undo all the effects of my wrong decision if I will let him.
Yeah.
That is your get out of jail free card.
It is. And we have reinforcement at every turn to keep us in the dream, but it's a dream. I mean, it's that whole metaphor of the theater again. It's like once you leave the theater, you realize that whole thing that I was involved in for, you know, in that metaphor, a couple hours, give or take, you know, a typical movie. Well, how many lifetimes have we spent in that theater? But it's a movie. And we were so enthralled with what we saw on the screen. We thought that the character that we, you know, identified with was, you know, in this big holographic movie, and this is not just a two-dimensional screen. We thought that three-dimensional character that I call mine Bruce and you call yours Lynn and whoever else is listening, you know, calls, you have your own name and seems amazingly real, but it's a movie. It's just a, you know, a whole, very impressive, but a moving hologram that had no bearing on the reality of what we all are eternally. So, yeah, and that's the relief, and that's the release, isn't it? Because it's realizing that we don't have to do anything now. We just have to get the heck out of the way, allow that release then to show us what was behind there, behind the little veil of smoke that the Course refers to at times, or what seems like this thick wall, but it's really, it was just nothing. It was just a hologram that we were able to, with our mind's technology, make it appear to have depth and breadth and duration and all these dimensions and weight and tactile feedback and all kinds of convincing stuff. I mean, woo, talk about special effects. but once you're out of the theater, it's like, that was a movie. And now we're back to reality. And I think that, you know, we can't even imagine how profoundly peaceful the reality that we're returning to is. And so that's why we keep falling back on the theatrical version that the ego has put out, because, you know, we keep thinking, well, man, maybe there's something here in the movie that is going to do it for me, you know. And eventually it's like, you know, like chapter 31, it says, you know, would you like to try all the roads, you know, and the real alternative section. Well, okay, maybe not, but boy, we seem like we sure go down them a lot. So let's see. I'm just going to read the concluding part, which is in chapter 5 here. It says, "Thus the first two steps of forgiveness represent our decision to let the Holy Spirit do his healing work in us." And that does require our cooperation to reveal that what seemed to be outside was in our mind. That's the first step. And then the second step, the release is just the letting go. Just seeing, okay, the guilt isn't real, so I can afford to let it go. That whole thought system of sin, guilt, fear, death, victimhood, projection, attack, defense, duality, separate interest, that whole mental mess was a mirage, to complete the alliteration there. it was just mindless madness that it was, you know, a tiny man idea that didn't have any consequence and therefore didn't affect reality. So it says, there's a prayer in the Course urges to do use whenever we're not joyous, and it contains the three steps we're describing. I must have decided wrongly because I'm not at peace. I made the decision myself, but I can also decide otherwise. I want to decide otherwise because I want to be at peace. I do not feel guilty because the Holy Spirit will undo all the consequences of my wrong decision if I will let him. I choose to let him by allowing him to decide for God for me. So that's a quick run through of the three R's. I hope you've enjoyed this. I'm reachable from ACIM blog and on Facebook at ACIM blog. And this is Bruce Rawls, and look forward to talking with you next week. And thank you, Lynn, for contributing tremendously to this this hour. And next week I'll I can't remember what I'm going to talk about, but it'll tie into this. So anyway, and I just to recap here, I was reading from miraclestudies.net/forgive_ and then the number 3 and then the word step.html, and I'll post that on ACIM blog. And let's see what else. Well, I've got a few seconds. Let me just read this. The last little paragraph says, "You are not trapped in the world you see because its cause can be changed. This change requires first that the cause be identified, and then second, let go, so that third, it can be replaced. The first two steps in this process require your cooperation. The final one does not." And there's the recap. Thank you all. Have a great week.
All right. Thank you, Bruce. And I'll talk to you Saturday. Bruce and I teach every Saturday morning at, 9 a.m. Eastern time. So that's 6 a.m. his time and 7 a.m. my time. So join us on Saturday morning. And then Bruce will be with us again next Sunday night for the third of this three-part mini-series. So once again, thank you, Bruce Rawls. And I absolutely love teaching with you and appreciate you. So see you next week.
All mutual. Thanks so much.